Good evening and welcome behind the news for June 22nd, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics, and a little of behind schedule tonight, thanks to those crack mass transit experts at the MTA. Got two guests lined up for tonight. First, about 10 minutes, you know, 7 minutes from now, maybe. The economist Julio Huato talking about immigration and also probably about the Mexican elections coming up. And then at the bottom of the hour, Ken Sherrill of the Hunter College Political Science Department. Since this is Pride Week and we're coming up to Pride Weekend, I thought to talk to Ken about the state of gay politics in America. Ken, one of the leading experts on that, public opinion and politics and all those related issues. Can the Republicans win once again on gay marriage, assuming they won last time? And just an abbreviated look at the headlines, given the late hour. First, this morning, the Labor Department reporting the number of first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose 11,000 on the week to 308,000, and the previous week's was revised upwards a little bit. This is a little below what Wall Street economists were expecting, but still it does a bit of an uptick after several weeks of fairly sharp declines. And the picture here is one of a labor market and an economy that is in good but not great shape and perhaps slowing down a bit, as is the broader economy, it does seem, irregularly, but that is the general trend. The University of Michigan reporting the other day that its monthly measure of consumer attitudes, its consumer sentiment survey, which is one of the leading such measures, up 3 points on the month. Surprising. Some analysts, although the weekly ABC numbers that we report here were showing signs of an increase after several months of decline. So this does look like the attitude of the American public is somewhat getting over high gasoline prices and maybe even rising the consumer attitudes rising a little bit with President Bush's approval ratings, which are climbing slowly out of the basement. How secure that recovery is, we shall see in the coming weeks. Another 10 cents or 20 cents in the gas price, and you could see Bush's approval ratings heading below 30%. As I've pointed out here before, extremely tight correlation between the president's approval ratings and movements in the price of gas, which is something that no previous president has really shown, at least since modern public opinion polling began, but Bush's fate seems singularly tied to the price of a gallon of gas. The weekly ABC News Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index rising 3 points on the week and regaining more than half of its slide. It slid very dramatically between April and late May, early April and late May, but it's regained much of that decline. So it does look like people are getting used to high gas prices and feeling a little better about their personal finances, but still considerable pessimism about the prospects for the U.S. economy. The leading indicators published by the Conference Board, so-called for their capacity or alleged capacity to forecast changes in the direction of the economy several months out, not because of their prominence, but because of their alleged prescience, that declining 0.6% on the month, and the results for February through April were also revised lower. Only 3 of the 10 components that make up the leading index were up in May. The rest were either flat or down. Again, consistent with a sign of a slowing, signs of a slowing economy later in the year. And then finally, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is not only more timely, but does seem to be more sensitive, at least in recent cycles. The index itself was up on a week, but its rate of change declining, which means that it does also point to a slowing economy in the coming months. So it does seem like high energy prices and higher interest rates are taking their toll on the U.S. economy, leading to a slowdown. And we'll see, given high household debt levels, whether a slowdown can stay a slowdown or will cascade into something more severe than that. We shall see in the coming weeks. And then a political observation here. The other day, The Note, a snotty but useful daily roundup of political news and gossip produced by ABC News, quoted Bush strategist Tucker Eskew as saying, "If you're spending your time denying your opponent's accusations while repeating your opponent's own words in your denials, then you're losing." Thus, with cut and run, the Democrats are busy denying that they're trying to cut and run in Iraq while using that very phrase over and over again. There's something brilliant, evil but brilliant, about the way the Republicans can come up with stupid killer phrases like that that define an issue in their way, and everyone seems to pick up on, either to support or dissent from. But it's their phrase that becomes the touchstone, which proves their dominance, or hegemony, if you prefer the magic theory word. Amazingly, despite the disaster that is the invasion of Iraq, the Republicans aren't running away from the issue. They're not making things up or pointing in other directions. They're confronting it head on, actually. They're embracing it passionately for the November midterm election. For a long time, I wondered why the Republicans were such good partisan fighters and the Dems always looked weak and vacillating, and not just on matters of principle. I kept wondering why they didn't have more partisan will to win, and it struck me a few months ago that it's because the Republicans actually do believe in something. Most of it is noxious, much of it is bordering on the insane, but they believe it all passionately, which is what makes them such fierce partisans. The Democrats are caught in a structural bind. They have to pretend to be the popular party while ultimately serving business interests. It's hard to believe in anything when you're so fundamentally divided. And so it looks like the Dems are blowing what could be a tremendous electoral advantage, with the president's approval ratings in the basement, those of Congress even lower, and a vast discontent upon the land. But as the old saying goes, you can't beat something with nothing, and the Dems right now look like they've got a lot of nothing. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back. Walk around the video store. And that in honor of Pride Weekend, that is the old mid-90s band Third Sex and their song Wonderful Life. And I think, is the guest arriving? Does that look like our guest? Our guest seems to be AWOL at the moment, but he may have just returned from his wanderings. I think here he comes. All right. Can we take a look? Do you have a little something we can use as transition here, Michael? Apologies for all the roughness here, but this is live radio for you. We'll be back in a moment. Okay. Alles ist in Ordnung, as they say in German. Everything is in order now. We're all back, and everything is going. And now I'm joined in the studio by Julia Huato, who is an economist with the Howard Samuel Center of CUNY and a native of Mexico, right?
That is correct.
Welcome to Behind the News, Julia. I wanted to talk about immigration, which is something, as you know, both as an economist and as from personal experience. Well, let me just start with a personal question. What's it feel like to be discussed in the public discourse as kind of a problem?
I have a hard time looking at it from just my personal experience. The first thing I notice is that there is no immigration crisis in the United States. If you look at the statistics, you don't see that there is a sudden, rapid, recent increase in the inflows of immigrants into the United States. So you wonder what the real reasons of immigration becoming a hot issue in the media.
And what do you think that might be?
I think it's clear that it's politics, that it's scapegoating.
Well, you say that if you look at the statistics, there has not been a great increase in the amount of immigration. That is not the impression that everybody has. So could you set people straight with some, a little fact-checking on that?
Sure. Studies looking at Census Bureau data sets, like, 2000 census, and then more recently the CPS, the current population survey, show that immigration flows peaked in 1999 or 2000, and that after that there was actually a decline in immigration flows, net immigration flows to the United States. And
Then after 9/11, it's been a very unfriendly environment.
That is correct. That is correct. And also, immigration flows somehow reflect the intensity of law enforcement on the border. And so it declined. I think that in 2004, 2005, there were slight increases, but still, we're talking approximately about 1.5 million people. I'm talking about both legal and undocumented immigration, and but it's nothing. It's still not at the level of 1999, 2000.
Not to mention early part of the 20th century when the numbers were huge. Everyone is convinced, or a lot of people are convinced. I shouldn't say everyone. A lot of people are convinced that the inflow of immigrants into the United States has been depressing wages, especially for people in the bottom end of the wage distribution. What do you make of that argument?
There is a dispute among economists. As far as I know, there are two kinds of studies. One kind of study conducted by Richard Freeman, Lawrence Katz, and another economist whose name I don't remember now. And then on the other side, you have studies conducted by David Card and Altonji. And these studies, they use different methodology. The Freeman, Katz, and Borges, George Borges. Yeah, that's right.
Who, by the way, is a Cuban immigrant and is now not very friendly towards the people who are coming in behind him.
There you go. Yeah, George Borges from San Diego. Yeah, University of California, San Diego, I think, right? They use a general equilibrium model. You know, people who are familiar with economic theory will know what I'm talking about. It's a theoretical device that requires very strong assumptions, and they
the
try
assumptions
to measure
being that the actual real world behaves the way the textbooks say it's
that
supposed
is correct,
to behave.
Pretty much.
And these to anybody who studied economics, these are some very strange assumptions. Very often,
that is right. I think some of those assumptions are very strong, and under those assumptions, they measure the impact both of immigration and trade. Trade is a way of immigration, you know, quote unquote, in the sense that, as I guess probably the best way to put it is as Carlos Salinas, the former Mexican president, once put it, telling his partner, the U.S. partner, George Bush, if you don't accept Mexican tomatoes, then you're going to have to accept Mexican tomato pickers. So in the sense that when Americans import goods that have a high content of unskilled labor, they are somehow, importing labor from abroad. So when Borges and Freeman and Lawrence Katz conduct this study, they find that there is a negative impact, particularly on low-skilled workers' conditions, both real wages and unemployment. But the size of that impact is rather modest.
Now, and as I remember, I've read some of their papers, and I don't recall them trying to control for the effects of eroding minimum wage or deunionization or anything else. They're just focusing on that single issue, right?
That is right. I mean, there are many ifs and buts, you know, that you can raise when you look at these studies. I think overall, you know, when you look at the macro conditions in the United States, difficulties in that working Americans face in terms of employment opportunities and real wages have much more to do with the general mismanagement of the economy in the last 5 years, 6 years, and because of immigration. So immigration has, if these studies are correct, immigration has a very minor impact, a negative impact on the working and living conditions of low-skilled workers in the U.S.
And then you mentioned some studies by David Card, which take a different point of view.
That's right. The David Card study actually, and in his last paper that I was just reading the other day, in January 1995, he put it on the web. I don't think it's still published in a journal, but in that study, he insists in using the local approach. What is the local approach? It uses a very simple market labor market model for particular places, particular geographic areas in the United States. It uses the PAMS data set. And that study shows that there is negligible impact on low-skill real wages and employment opportunities. And the reason may be in part because what happens when there is a strong inflow of immigrants into a certain area of the country, or like a city, like a large city, most of the accommodation takes place within the industry and not like Freeman and Katz and Borges assume that happens because of inter-industrial switching of resources. I think he makes a very compelling case. And I forgot to mention there are also other studies that that were conducted by, I think, Michael Greenwood from the University of Colorado at Boulder. He and a Mexican economist whose name I forgot. They actually look at particular towns or particular cities in those states that have a high immigrant population: California, Texas, Arizona, Illinois, New Mexico, and they found overall also a very small local effect. That's what those studies show, and I believe them.
I'm speaking with Julio Huato, the economist at the Howard Samuel Center, City University of New York. Something that is not usually discussed in the United States is the impact of immigration from Mexico to the United States on Mexico. What does that look like? For example, today's Wall Street Journal has an article on a number of electoral districts in Mexico that have been pretty much emptied out of population. What is the effect on Mexico of having so many people leave?
Yeah, that's a terrible loss of key resource for the country. And something that studies are showing is that in the last decade or so, the number of educated or higher skilled Mexicans who have been immigrating has increased. That means very little in the United States. It's very small compared to whatever you compare it to in the U.S. But in Mexico, that's an important loss. That's one aspect. And there is another aspect that actually, because of economic conditions in Mexico, politicians have used, which is the fact that Mexican immigrants in the United States send large amounts of money in remittances to their families in Mexico. That's now I believe it's approximately like 10% of the income that Mexico receives in their current account of the balance of payments. So we're talking about a very significant amount of money per year.
And so that the outflow of people and the inflow of cash is a pretty important safety valve for a Mexican economy, which is not in great shape, right?
That is right. The main reasons why we have participated in this wave of immigration to the United States in the last 20 years. It has to do with two factors, two main factors. One is a demographic factor, and the other is an economic factor. The demographic factor, just quickly, has to do with what demographers call the demographic transition, meaning that in the 1960s and early 1970s, still the birth rate in Mexico was very high. So and it was up to the mid-1970s that it started to decline. So that means that 20 years later, there was going to be a large contingent of young people joining the labor force in Mexico. And that happened in the 1980s and early 1990s, and that's exactly when Mexican economy was in very bad shape as a result of the debt crisis. The rapid growth in Mexican immigration to the United States comes from 1970, and it accelerated very rapidly in the 1980s. So that's the demographic part combined with the economic debacle in Mexico after 1982, after the oil boom ended.
And, of course, NAFTA hasn't unleashed the boom that its promoters promised, has it?
Yeah, there is a lot of controversy about NAFTA. I tend to kind of steer away from pointing to NAFTA, specifically the treaty, as, you know, the culprit for, you know, for the expulsion of Mexican workers, you know. It's very difficult to pin down, like econometrically, it's very difficult to pin down the NAFTA effect. And that's one of the reasons is that the implementation of NAFTA in January 1994 coincided with, almost coincided, like a few months later, with the meltdown of the peso. December 1994, the peso went down. Most economists that I know of agree that the fall of the peso had nothing to do with NAFTA. There were other reasons that explained that. And
the understanding of our neighbors here on Wall Street is that there was a big inflow of money into Mexico in anticipation of a boom that NAFTA would unleash.
That's
the boom
right.
Didn't materialize, and then the money turned out.
That's
turned
right.
Back.
That is
but,
correct.
So that would suggest it was a reaction to the failure of NAFTA, not to its implementation or success.
Right, but the failure, that may
or
have
its failure been, to generate a boom that was advertised that it was going to generate.
Yeah, well, I would agree with the idea that because of the rapid liberalization of the movements of capital into and out of Mexico, that had to do with the virulence of the 1994-1995 crisis in Mexico. But specifically NAFTA as such, I would have a harder time.
Yeah, well, this is an evolving relationship between the two countries that has been going on for a very, very long time.
And that
just,
is right.
Just pointing to this one piece of paper.
That is right.
Is really exaggerating that piece of paper. Its importance too much, right?
Absolutely. And NAFTA reflects the basic asymmetry in power between the three countries and between the two.
Well, there's the big guy, the less big guy, and the not so big guy.
That is right.
We have only got a few minutes left, but Mexico has an election coming up, and there's some anxiety around the United States that we're going to have a Hugo Chavez on our doorstep. What do you make of the upcoming presidential election?
I think Hugo Chavez is unique. You know, he's a Venezuelan phenomenon, and I wish him well. In Mexico, I think López Obrador has a pretty good chance. There was a little bit of alarm because some polls were showing that he was losing some ground.
And the right wing was saying, he was a kind of Chavez figure and using that as a scare tactic.
They were using that as a scare tactic, but he's.
Why should people be afraid of Hugo Chavez? Why should the common people of Mexico? Why did that succeed? That he's a bogeyman.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably if Wall Street people think that way, they are probably wrong, even in terms of their own interests. But actually, I heard on TV the other day somebody from one of the big firms in investment banks in Wall Street saying that they weren't concerned about the victory of the left in Mexico, that they didn't expect like dramatic changes. And López Obrador has been saying that he, number one, plans to stick to reasonable macroeconomic policies. He does plan to attack very strongly poverty and inequality in Mexico, but the focus is on combating tax evasion and tax elusion through loopholes and tax planning, so called, and also attacking corruption. Basically, he's going to go very very strongly against corruption, and he has experience doing that. He was mayor of Mexico City. And he demonstrated that it was possible to balance the books and at the same time help the disadvantaged. And he became extremely popular as a result.
Just got a couple of minutes, about 30 seconds remaining. But Mexico had historically had a pretty independent foreign policy from the United States. It's gotten a lot more friendly to the United States in recent years. Do you think López Obrador would mean a return to some degree of independence, or is this subordination to U.S. interests now complete?
I think that address, Manuel López Obrador, is definitely going to be much more independent. He's strongly nationalist. That doesn't mean that he's going to pick fights with the United States unnecessarily, but he's going to defend the national sovereignty strongly. That's my reading of his agenda.
And were he to win, would it look like this spread of rebellion against neoliberalism across Latin America? Was that actually a pretty significant increase in the anti-neoliberal camp?
I think that you can join the dots in that sense, but I think that the phenomenon in Mexico really responds to local conditions.
So people who are going to vote for him do not see themselves as part of a continent-wide movement or anything like that.
Right. I don't believe that they see themselves that way. I mean, there are very strong commonalities among Latin American countries, and there is a secular trend towards integration that has been betrayed for different reasons. One of them is the U.S. pulling Mexico apart. But I think that if the left wins in Mexico, they are going to take care of national business first, and then López Obrador has been saying that he doesn't want a very protagonistic foreign policy for Mexico, that Mexico has to focus first on solving internal problems, basically inequality and poverty.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Julio Huato, an economist who is from Mexico but now in the United States at the Howard Samuels Institute at CUNY. Thank you. And let's take a little break and we'll be back.
Hi, this is Steve Earle, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio. And support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Says, come back, Woody Guthrie. I come back to us now. I tell you, eyes from paradise.
And we're back. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And let's take another musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Ken Sherrill.
Don't tell us we only care about the dykes and fags. Don't try to find fake reasons to hate us. Some people get it. Lots more people need it.
And around that. A little excerpt from I'm Illegal by Team Dresch, continuing with our sampling of lesbian bands in celebration of Pride Week. And now we're joined in the studio by Ken Sherrill, who's a professor of political science at Hunter College and a big baseball fan, fresh from Shea Stadium, where I just learned the Mets won. Not that I know what that all means, but anyway. So, Ken, it looks like the Republicans plan to campaign on, well, they seem to be campaigning on Iraq, which is kind of a stunner, but they also seem to be campaigning on gay marriage. Do you think it's going to work for them?
Well, I think they're campaigning on Iraq because gay marriage doesn't have the traction it used to have. And
really? Well, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that it won them the election in 2004.
I don't think it did. I don't think it won them the election. The best that could be said is that it enabled them to counter-mobilize enough to equalize the massive turnout of anti-Bush voters. Every bit of statistical evidence I've seen indicates that gay marriage had no net effect on the outcome of the election. If you go down to county-level returns in Ohio, if you look at the other states where there were referenda, there simply wasn't a measurable impact. In fact, if you regress the percent increase in the Bush vote against voting on the referenda, the regression is flat and somewhat negative. That is, the referenda were on the ballot in states that Bush would have carried anyway, for the most part. There are obviously a couple of possible exceptions, like Ohio. But if you get down to county-level data on Ohio, it shows no net impact whatsoever.
Now, the hardcore Christian right is always threatening to sit on its hands because they say the Bush administration is not being friendly enough to their agenda. I don't know what more they want, but apparently it's not good enough for them. First of all, do you buy that threat? And second of all, is that all that serious a threat?
I think that they may be turning a reality into a threat. That is, it may be that Bush has become so unpopular that they can't mobilize their troops. And seeing that they can't mobilize their troops, they're threatening Bush by saying, if you don't do burning at the stake for witches, so on and so forth, we're not going to mobilize our troops. If you look at the plummet in Bush's approval ratings, not only about moderate Republicans, but among strong Republicans, it looks as if those troops are not going to be mobilized. And the reasons range, as you well know, from the price of gas to the war, to the failure of the government to deliver in Katrina, to burnout after 6 years. They're at this point in rough shape. I think that's why Iraq does become a viable option for them. That is, in a sense of despair, you turn to nationalism and you try a rally around the flag approach. I think that's what's going on.
And say your opponents are weak and cowardly.
Which they often are.
Yes, but not quite the same way.
Right, not doing cutting and running, but yeah. Not having courage or their convictions.
Well, I'm interested that you said at the top of this interview that the issue of gay marriage and the sort of related social issues don't have the traction that they once did. Could you expand on that and why is that?
If you look at the survey data, the percent of people supporting one of the constitutional amendments has gone down. The percent of people supporting some kind of compromise like civil unions has gone up. There's been marriage in Massachusetts for 2 years, and the world hasn't come to an end. It's becoming...
Well, that's why God gave us Hurricane Katrina, right?
Right. It's becoming like abortion. And I think the analogy to abortion is very strong, which is that it will take the Democrats a very long time to learn that they can be forthright on abortion. And it'll be very long for the Democrats to realize they can be forthright on equal rights for gay people. the Republicans use it as a threat against the Democrats that makes it difficult for the Democrats to mobilize their base, facilitates Republican mobilization of their base. It's a game of chicken, and frankly, in games of chicken, the Republicans tend to beat the Democrats.
Yes, they, they're very good at those games
yeah,
of chicken.
Yeah.
Well, it was Bob Kuttner in a column a week or two ago opened with the lead that this is the Democratic Party today, that it's worse to oppose gay marriage than it is to support the repeal of the inheritance tax. And I think he's using that as shorthand for, like, you know, this kind of what we need to do to beat the Republicans on the social issues is take this line of economic populism.
Well,
do you think there's any relation to those two at all?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that the Republican strategy is to set the agenda and is to set the terms of debate and to have the Democrats playing defense and to play defense on the Republicans' turf being social issues. The Democrats have to learn that they can make an effort to set the agenda. And that probably would be an economic agenda if they want to prevail in the next election. It might be a leadership agenda also. It's another area in which the Democrats are very weak. When you look at the polling data from 2004, what jumps out is that voters came to the conclusion that they knew who George Bush was, and they really didn't know who John Kerry was, in the sense that they didn't know what they could trust him on and what they couldn't trust him not to do, having, in Bush's terms, flip-flopped so much.
Democrats actually said things like, I was before the war, I was against it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Republican strategy is to have the Democrats turn somersaults on foreign policy, on social issues, and to prevent any kind of focus on a domestic economic agenda. I think the effort to set a minimum wage the other day was certainly a step in the right direction. I think that some sort of effort to enable minimum wage workers to unionize is part of a successful agenda. I think that John Edwards has got it right in terms of articulating a message that may resonate and that doesn't prevent you from being decent on a whole range of social issues and so on. I think that most of the Democratic leadership, especially the DLC types, simply are afraid to take the economic agenda. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm wondering. I started this program with a commentary that it's not that the Democrats' structural problem is that they have to pretend to be a popular party when their paymasters are in the business class. And this gives them this very divided message, divided loyalties, and it's impossible to reconcile those contradictions. What do you think of that? Or why is it they so repeatedly seem to shoot themselves in the foot?
A glib answer is to say a failure of leadership. It's a failure to have the courage of their convictions and frankly, a desire not to lose as opposed to a desire to win. Unlike the Republicans, the Democrats frequently seem to be afraid to mobilize their base. The inability of Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act yesterday is a classic of how brassy the Republicans are prepared to be in order to win an election. The Democrats are frankly still afraid to speak honestly about race, something they've been afraid to speak honestly about since 1972 or 76, ever since Willie Horton. There is no urban agenda. There is no housing policy. There's no full employment policy. There are no policies that resonate with rank-and-file voters who place a low priority on social issues. But absent an economic agenda that resonates with people who don't care much about social issues will resonate when everything else is a vacuum.
I'm speaking with Ken Churl of the Hunter College Political Science Department. The resonance of social issues, I know that there's some, I've seen some polling data that suggests that they resonate more with older voters than younger voters.
They resonate with younger voters, but on the other side.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the people who take the kind of classic right-wing Republican approach on the social issues tend to be older rural people.
And less well-educated.
Will that kind of politics just die out? I mean, does this face a demographic or actuarial fate?
Well, I don't think anybody who cares about those issues is willing to wait for them to die out that way. You're talking 20 years, 25 years. One of the interesting things, one of the sad things about the way the Republicans seized the agenda on marriage is that it wiped non-discrimination in employment off of the agenda entirely. The amazing thing is that no effort has been made since the end of the Carter administration by the Democrats to get non-discrimination employment on the national agenda.
Which is a fairly popular thing, right?
Oh, yes. It's supported by 75% of Americans. We've seen it passed in state after state now. What's happening is that the movement on the social issues is happening at the state level. Just as in South Dakota, the Republican abortion bill has been stopped by a popular initiative. That is by a popular initiative going on the ballot. At the state level, one sees much more courage, and also people are much more willing to understand that there's no cost to these issues. It's at the national level that there's a crisis of leadership.
What is the relationship of the prominent gay and lesbian political organizations to the Democratic Party? Is it are they very tightly bound, or are they willing to act independently?
I think it's a little bit of each. I mean, there's a lot of electoral capture. There's a lot of the sense that gay people have nowhere to go but the Democrats. Just as one thinks about the electoral capture of African Americans, that is, there's no good reason for any African American to support the Republicans. So the Democrats have to deliver much less than they might if that vote were competitive. The relationship with the Democratic Party is more tenuous, but for a kind of complex social scientific reason. You've got to assume that gay people are randomly distributed about the population at birth. And what that means is that Republicans are as likely to be parents of gay kids as are Democrats. Conservatives are as likely to be parents of gay kids as are liberals. And partisanship and ideology are transmitted through the family. Yet gay people rank somewhere between African American and Jews in terms of being disproportionately likely to vote Democratic. For a very large number of gay people, that represents a real break with family tradition, with all sorts of socialization. If the Democratic Party doesn't deliver on the unequal rights for gay people, and the Republican Party begins to deliver on economic issues, on foreign policy issues, on strength of leadership that resonate with childhood socialization, then it's relatively easy for there to be an ebb in rank and file gay support for our Democratic candidates. We've seen, for example, in New York last year in the Democratic primary an openly gay candidate for borough president came in a very strong fourth who wasn't supported or endorsed by a single gay political organization. Gay voters are much more independent than many of the national and local organizations believe them to be.
But they have been, until now at least, reliably Democratic voters.
Well, when the Republican Party runs against their rights, what choice do you have?
But
you can stay home.
What is the state of the log cabin Republicans these days? That seems like a pretty beleaguered and dwindling organization.
You know, they actually have extraordinary leadership. Patrick Guerrero is leaving them, but I the opportunities I've had to meet him and work with him, I think he's one of the most intelligent and effective leaders on the scene in the movement.
Really?
Yeah, I think there'll be, you know, the question of who will succeed him, is because it's a miserable job. But he's an extraordinarily adept politician.
Well, then I would. It must be kind of tough to have a job where your party shuns you, or actually views you as an agent of the devil, isn't it?
Yes, I don't envy him for a minute. His new position, by the way, is with a political action fund that Tim Gill is setting up, which is designed to make life miserable for our enemies. The thinking behind it is that of a lot of the people, say, behind the Family Marriage Amendment could have been stopped when they were candidates for school board and state legislature and so on. And there's going to be targeting of extreme anti-gay candidates at the state and local level.
From within the Republican Party?
From an external political action committee that will force them to fight much harder to get elected and reelected. It will force them to raise and spend much more money, to campaign harder. That is, they're going to have to defend themselves, because many of these people have cast extraordinarily unpopular votes on economic issues and on foreign policy issues. It's not terribly expensive to run a television ad campaign against a member of Congress or a member of the state legislature who's cast lots of bad votes, and to put them on the defensive. And the strategy of this organization is going to be to make the opposition pay for targeting our rights. And I think that Guerrero is exactly the person to do this. It's going to be nonpartisan.
And when's this is starting up now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And will they be active in the coming November election?
Yes, yes.
So, and they'll just be attacking the bad guys without overtly supporting opponents?
I think that there's also going to be something of an effort to recruit and develop candidates on the good side. But as I understand it, the goal is to make the opposition pay. Do I have a moment? I can tell you, for example, about some of what...
You've got a few minutes here.
Marilyn Musgrave, who's the House sponsor of the Federal Marriage Amendment.
Where's she from?
Colorado. 2 years ago, a predecessor to this organization decided to make her pay. They ran two television ads. One highlighted her vote to place a tax on funerals or funeral homes that depicted her at a funeral picking the pocket of a body in a coffin.
Gives new meaning to the death tax.
Right, exactly. The second was her vote against the pay raise for soldiers in combat in Iraq. And in this ad, she was seen sneaking up on a soldier in the middle of a firefight, reaching into his back pocket, pulling out some cash, dropping it into her handbag, and trooping away. Well, she had to spend a hell of a lot more money getting reelected than she's ever had to spend before. And she had to divert a lot of her time from what else she usually does in order to run for reelection. If you tell politicians that there are real costs to this kind of bigotry, then they can find some other target like Charles Darwin to run against. But, you know, this gets them off of this issue. So it's fighting fire with fire in a very creative way. I'm very excited by this.
That's very interesting. But it's also interesting how you portray a much more open and tolerant politics at the local level, at the grassroots level, than we see at the national level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is there such a disconnect between the macro and the micro?
I really think it's a failure of leadership. I think that in the Democratic Party, it's out-and-out cowardice at the national level. I think that at the state level, at the city level, mayors and governors and state legislators have learned that this is a cost-free issue, that all hell is not going to break loose. And it's easy to move. It's something you can deliver at a time of constricted state budgets. It's something you can deliver to a constituency that doesn't involve spending any money. I think that's a very important part of it. It's also an area where the opposition really doesn't exist anymore. I mean, you don't get into any trouble for voting for non-discrimination legislation at the state and local level. People aren't defeated. People don't have tough campaigns. Voters
do
don't
people
give
lose over their vote in gay marriage?
Virtually none. And what's interesting there is that there have been, in recent years, more defeats of people who voted against gay marriage. Massachusetts is notable for the number of incumbents who were beaten in primaries by supporters of equal marriage rights after they voted against equal marriage. There is, in fact, more cost to being on the wrong side of this. Some of this is generational. The people who vote wrong tend to be people who've been in office for a long time, who are out of touch with their district, who haven't noticed how their constituency hasn't changed. They make a misstep thinking that their constituents are more prejudiced than they are, or think that the constituents are prejudiced when they're not. And old-line political organizations are very weak. Bright young people come in, organize the neighborhood. They pluck off somebody whose career was near its end anyway but didn't know it. The cost of being wrong on this, that is, the cost of not supporting equal rights, is beginning to be greater than the cost of supporting it. And I think that's the message that our community's organizations have got to get across to national Democrats and also to some Republicans. I mean, granted, you know, given gerrymandering of congressional seats, most seats are safe, so on and so forth, you still can lose primaries. Democrats who don't have the courage to be on the right side of this can lose their primaries. And I think that's the way of the future. And Republicans who are on the wrong side are going to have to spend a lot of more money.
A couple of seconds remaining. Yeah. But so does this mean that the fall campaign is not going to be about same-sex marriage the way some of us were frightened that it would be?
Who knows? I think the Republicans are trying to see what they can do on Iraq. Because push comes to shove, they are stronger on foreign policy. They can try to rally around the president. This may fail utterly. If Iraq fails, then I think, you know, you're back to same-sex marriage, burning the flag, and maybe Charles Darwin. But
hey, it's worked in the past for them, right?
Well, their problem is that with an unpopular president, they're going to have very low turnout. And they have to figure out some way to get people to turn out and vote. I'm not sure this is going to cut it this year.
All right. Well, this is some better news than I expected. Thanks for joining us, Ken Charles.
Pleasure
Ken Charles is a professor of political science at Hunter College. And I did want to announce a couple of readings, if I can find my notes here. Yes. Nation columnist Katha Pollitt, who will be a guest in this show in 2 weeks, will be reading from her collection Virginity or Death at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side, 82nd and Broadway, this coming Tuesday, June 27th at 7. And then my guest from 2 weeks ago, Ned Sublett, will be performing at the Bowery Poetry Club, Bowery and Bleecker in the East Village, the day after, Wednesday the 28th at 8 p.m. sharp, it says, since there are a lot of people on that lineup. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood, and let's go out with This from Lesbians on Ecstasy, a Montreal-based band that takes a lot of old classic, like Melissa Etheridge and K.D. Lang songs and technos them up. And this is called Parachute Clubbing. Till next week. Bye.